ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, and welcome to Soul Search. I'm Meredith Blake. Who would you say are your environmental heroes? You know, the folks that you really admire for their ideas or their activism or maybe their leadership as we navigate a changing climate. Have a think for a sec, but what are the chances that you'd name a medieval saint?
Francis is often kind of pictured as the birdbath saint, you know, because there's a story of him preaching to the birds, being friendly to the animals and taming the wolves and that sort of thing. But what is actually like going on theologically is a sense of the healing of the relationship between humanity and the rest of creation.
St. Francis of Assisi looms large in some people's ecological thinking, and he belongs to a whole tradition of European mystics who've been interested in outer and inner landscapes. Rachel Davies is a research fellow with the Institute for Religion and Critical Inquiry at the Australian Catholic University in Melbourne. She studies the European mystics. She's also a forest therapy guide. Rachel, hello.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
I want to get a dose of forest therapy, actually. Okay. Take me to the Dandenong Ranges. Describe for me what it's like and what do you feel when you go there for forest therapy?
So the Dandenong Ranges are east of Melbourne, and I moved there during the pandemic, just before the pandemic started. And as many of us did, spent a lot of time outdoors walking and just felt myself coming into a new space. This was before I was a forest therapy guide. You can probably hear from my accent that I'm from the Northern Hemisphere. I was born in Canada. Uh-huh. And when I moved here, it was kind of on the back of a big personal change and some loss. And I felt like I didn't really know myself. And going out into the forest gave me a space to explore that, because it was a landscape that I was very unfamiliar with as someone new to this land. So it was really beautiful. It helped me accept that kind of unknowing of myself and feel comfortable with it.
That's a remarkable thing to say, Rachel. I mean, I think a lot of us, and there's a trope, isn't there? Like, so many people over the history of our species have gone into the forest to find themselves, but to come back, in fact, with a sense of not knowing, that's perhaps counterintuitive on a cultural level. So what do you mean?
Yeah, I mean, maybe it's sort of the same thing, isn't it? I think that we are hyper-obsessed with who we are, and we are always on the search. And I guess my work in the mystics and these ancient texts have taught me that it's really by forgetting oneself, but not in a kind of, you know, masochistic sort of way, but by relinquishing one's attachment to who one thinks one is, mm-hmm. and being free to be taken into a mystery, that we feel and become at home in ourselves. Mm.
What do you think it was about the forest that was effective in that for you?
I think I spend a lot of time in my head, and when I'm in the forest or when I'm in, you know, a natural landscape, I'm really drawn out of myself because my senses are all engaged. And I mean, when people talk about meditation or prayer, oftentimes it's kind of construed as a sort of very interior process. You go inward, you kind of forget what is outside, detach from senses. But it really is about, for me, engaging with the senses, not becoming attached to them. But I find that I'm able to enter this kind of self-forgetfulness because I can smell, I can see, I can touch, and I'm carried beyond the kind of the busyness in my head and brought into a really physical space that allows me to just kind of ramble, and it feels really good, and I get into flow and I love it. Yeah.
Yeah. Makes me want to go for a walk with you.
yeah. You should come.
Yeah, I'd love that. I mean, I'm also really interested in just how popular forest bathing or forest therapy has become, but I'm also aware that there are multiple sources for this kind of practice. One of them is, well, in Japanese, it's known as Shinrin-yoku. It's a Shinto-related practice of forest bathing. So I wonder if you could just elaborate on what you mean by forest therapy and how you would describe the philosophical taproots of that as a practice. Does it connect for you to that Japanese tradition, or are there other sources?
Well, I did receive training in the Japanese-inspired form of forest bathing, Shinrin-yoku. And there's a big training institute here in Victoria, in Geelong, that I trained with. And I was excited to do that because it seemed like an excuse to spend time outdoors and a kind of way to organize my inner longings and the things that I enjoyed. So, I mean, that practice began in the 1980s in Japan, just kind of as a response to the crisis in overwork and stress. And there's a lot of good scientific research backing up the, you know, the efficacy of forest therapy as a public health practice. So that was my training. But since then, I've kind of evolved my practice. And my research is in Western mystical texts, European mystical texts. So I've been running a series of walks that I call Walking with the Mystics. And I use some of what I've learned from forest therapy to help people and to help myself, really, to journey inward to the kind of inner landscapes, you know, that I mentioned at the beginning about that kind of place of, for me, it has been a place of coming into my own unknowing of myself and releasing what I think I know to infinite possibility of what I might become and a real sense of freedom, you know, growing into that freedom at least day by day.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it began in the Japanese practice for me, although, of course, this experience, this practice of going out into natural landscapes is very ancient, certainly in the texts that I study and in the tradition I study. For hundreds and thousands of years, people going out into the deserts and experiencing wonder and a sense of awe and being drawn into the mystery.
Anything, I mean, in a Buddhist context, all those practices of walking meditation that often occur within forests, in a way, there's something almost universal, perhaps, in this impulse, I think.
Yeah. And I think at a moment when we're also thinking a lot and talking about neurodiversity, it's really useful to have this as a practice because the kind of traditional ways that people talk about meditation or prayer, sitting still, closing your eyes, you know, folding your hands or finding a certain posture or whatever, that can be really helpful to some people, but it can be difficult for other people depending on who they are and how they move through the world. And so having a way to practice this that involves movement, it's really important to reclaim that. I think it's always been there, but in the kind of popular talk about meditation and the way it's often taught, we forget that this movement, that this is contemplation, this is meditation.
Yeah.
This is a way it's often been done because that's how we are and what we need as humans.
Mm. Rachel, you've already indicated that you study the medieval mystics. And I'd love to just hear more about that process of connecting this practice that in a way arose in a very particular set of personal circumstances for you with not only your research, but the long tradition that you tap into with that research. Just where would you begin to tell the story of the relationship between landscapes and what we might describe as the soul? Where do you start thinking about that?
Yeah, I think it's ubiquitous in Western mystical texts, and it might be through all mystical texts, I can't say, but just the ones I study, it really is, because as teachers, the mystics offer a kind of smorgasbord of landscapes to help us think about what it might mean or look like to journey inward to God, to the divine, to the true and deepest sense of the self. So like going way back, deserts, mountains, forests, the self as a tree, Meister Eckhart going into the ground, you know, the ground of the soul. Mm. And these landscapes are just everywhere. Teresa of Avila, the interior castle, you know, where the soul is like a kind of luminous crystalline structure that one moves deeply inward to the center of oneself where one finds God. And of course, the deepest part of the self is where God is, and who we are is most deeply found in, you know, God's own being. So it really goes back, I think, this theme of inwardness has been a really exciting one for me lately. all the way to Augustine, you know, writing in the 4th, 5th century, who talks about this. He says, you know, speaking to God in the confessions, you were within me, but I was outside myself. Mm. People go abroad to admire the heights of mountains, the mighty waves of the sea, the broad tides of rivers, the compass of the ocean, the circuits of the stars, yet pass over the mystery of themselves without a thought. And so this whole language emerged in mystical texts, language and imagery really to help us navigate that journey inward to that mystery of who we are, which is an ever unfolding mystery that is not a closed thing and that is endlessly expansive. So, yes, I think that's where it begins in these texts, these wonderful metaphors, and spatial as well. Like, yeah, there's physical landscapes, but there's also directional landscapes, like inwardness, like I just mentioned. Ascent is another big one, so that will align with, like, journeying up the mountain. Mm. There's all kinds. There's just so many. So, yeah.
Yeah. Augustine's Confessions are often described as kind of the first autobiography, in a way, because of that really sharp sense of interiority that comes through. But you work with the mystics, and I guess I don't really think of him as one of them.
Oh, he's totally a mystic.
Really?
Absolutely.
Make
the
case. Come on, convince me.
I mean, just those passages I was just sharing, like, it's, I mean, what is a mystic, right?
Good question. What do you think?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's several different approaches that one could take to that question. And one approach that has been taken is a mystic is someone who has a lot of experiences, like, you know, there's phenomenon, there's visions and intense feelings and that sort of thing. And that's one way to think about it. And that's kind of like William James and
yeah.
And that's fine. That's a more kind of, I think, modern way of thinking about what a mystic is. But in these kind of medieval texts that I look at, a mystic is someone who is on a journey that is transformative. And it's actually often about the denial of experiences. Experiences are helpful and good and may help us on that journey of transformation, but it's very easy to become attached to them and to think that they are the end. But actually, if we are on a journey into the mystery of who we are, we have to try to resist defining who we are by the phenomenon we experience or by whatever happens, right?
Yeah.
So we have to relinquish that, let it go, and move beyond. And so that is like a huge thing in these mystical texts. We talk about, you know, apophatic theology, negative theology, like denying these things, not getting hung up on them, to move to a transformation that is actually a kind of ethical transformation, a kind of growth in virtue that is at the same time a noetic. It happens because our sense of knowing of God, ourselves, others, including non-human others, the natural world, becomes transformed and we see them from within the mystery that God is.
I'm not going to ask you to nominate your favourite mystic,
Rachel.
Hard. It would. Maybe mine is Francis of Assisi.
Oh, he's
maybe.
So lovely.
I think a lot of people have a soft
Very
spot.
Relatable.
Yeah. And I wonder if you could just introduce us again to him. Who was Francis and what kind of mystic was he?
Yeah. Well, Francis, he's kind of born at the end of the 12th century into the early part of the 13th century. And he was part of a new movement of, there was a lot of change happening in Europe, in Western Europe at that time. There had been political changes and a new kind of mobility among the new emerging merchant class and the emergence of cities and that sort of thing. So Francis, his father was a merchant. You know, he had things going for him. He had money and he had popularity. Yeah, he was just out there doing his life. And he came into this very deep experience of, I guess, comprehending his own fragility through his encounter with the form of the crucified Christ and through Christ, that crucified suffering Christ present in the suffering of others. So the famous story, of course, is of his encounter with someone who was suffering from leprosy. And he encounters this person and he kisses the leper because it is actually the presence of Christ there in the physical body of another person. And so his spirituality becomes very what we would call sacramental in this way. Mm. The idea that the sacred, that God is present in the physical world, and that kind of that beauty and grace of the divine comes to us through the physical world. But it is a very, that physical world is a vulnerable and fragile world. Mm. And through that encounter with this figure, he also comes into a deep awareness of his own vulnerability and his own poverty. And so poverty becomes a big thing for Francis. He kind of, there's this wonderful image of him kind of stripping off all his clothes and yeah. giving them back to his father, giving back his father's name and everything, and just kind of going into the wild with his own, I don't know, the truth of who he really is, unadorned. Yeah. And what it's speaking of here is he's getting at that we have an essential ontological poverty, that our whole existence is contingent, that it is not something that we create for ourselves, but it is given. So there's a sense of the giftedness of life. And the reason to pursue poverty is to kind of shed the illusion that we create our own lives, that we make it happen, and a living into an embrace of that vulnerability, which I think is so important in our time in history, you know, where the earth is, we're coming into awareness of the fragility of the earth.
This is Soul Search by podcast and on ABC Radio National. I'm Meredith Lake, and I'm talking with Rachel Davies. She's a forest therapy guide, and as an academic, she studies the medieval European mystics. And I suspect that it's no accident that St. Francis of Assisi has come to the fore again now, you know, in the Anthropocene, as we all face our own fragility among the wider community of life. At the same time, Francis's famous Canticle of the Creatures speaks about humanity and vulnerability in ways that remain really striking.
So this is the part of Francis that most people know or maybe have heard about, and it's really lovely. I mean, Francis is often kind of pictured as the birdbath saint, you know.
The birdbath saint, I haven't heard that before.
he's in lots of gardens and you know, because there's a story of him preaching to the birds, and it all sounds very quaint and everything. But what is actually like going on theologically behind these pictures of Francis being friendly to the animals and taming the wolves and that sort of thing is a sense of the healing of the relationship between humanity and the rest of creation, an acknowledgement that we kind of exist in a state of alienation from all that is the material world, including our own bodiliness. And in those stories, Francis is reconciling with the creation. And so this thing that we're celebrating, the 800 years, is of the Canticle of the Creatures. That is a wonderful piece of writing that he composes right towards the end of his life. And he's actually, like, it's so lyrical and so beautiful. And the way he speaks of the brotherliness and the sisterliness of all of the parts of the natural world and our part in that creation. And yet his own self, as he's writing that, he's very ill. And he actually has lost his vision by this point. He's nearing his death. And yet he is able to write with this deep kind of sensitivity and awareness of the beauty of creation. Maybe it's because he is in such a vulnerable place that he is able to feel his equality with other parts of the created world that are also vulnerable. So he talks about
kinship, even. That's what's so striking, that idea of kinship.
Yeah. So he calls brother sun and sister moon and brothers wind and air and clouds and sister water. And he kind of goes through this wonderful long list of the creatures, calling them by name and welcoming them in kinship and feeling his own welcome with them. And it's just really lovely how that kind of arises out of his own fragility. Mm. I think that's no accident.
And what did it mean for his vision of the divine? I mean, I think in some ways the ideas you're describing are familiar to us now. And yet for him it was about the worship of God as well. Can you just elaborate on how you connect those things together?
Look, I think it's important to remember that when a medieval person is talking about God, they mean goodness. So there's a really kind of thick metaphysics going on as well. So goodness, being, God are all sort of, they're the same thing. So a lot of people, when they talk about God today, they're maybe talking about, I don't know, an old man in the sky or somebody like us that's just bigger and more powerful. But that is not what Francis has in mind. So he speaks about encountering God through creatures rather than like God being actually the creatures. He's not what has been called like a pantheist. He worships God through creatures because he's actually talking about goodness. He's talking about the good. So he would say that all of the creatures that exist, and you and I and everybody, we are basically little epiphanies of goodness. And so we encounter goodness itself with a capital G through the kind of sacramental reality of the goodness of creatures that participate in that goodness with a capital G. Yeah, so that's kind of what he's operating with.
I mean, and that's fascinating given what you were saying about suffering and vulnerability, which is not devoid of pain, right?
No.
That this perception of goodness can coexist there and give rise to this perspective of brotherliness with all that lives. Mm. And I mean, you've kind of traced that cluster of ideas through what we might now describe as the Franciscan tradition. And I wonder if you could just plot out where this current runs in the next phase of Christian spirituality in Europe.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think, first of all, it's interesting to note that actually at the end of the canticle, there is a kind of acknowledgement of suffering. So he goes through all of a lot of creatures and says, you know, we praise you through Brother, Son, and Sister Moon. And then at the end, there's a kind of welcoming of what he calls Sister Death, which seems to me to be a kind of acknowledgement that all of this sense of kinship is happening within the context of our shared fragility. And that current matures, like Francis represents kind of some of the opening overtures to a movement that grows and swells over the next couple hundred years that some have called passion mysticism. Mm. So a real turning to the suffering of Jesus, specifically the humanity of Jesus, which it involves a recognition of our own suffering as human beings who share Christ's humanity and the humanity of God. And I guess what is happening historically here, there's a lot of stuff. There's, of course, I mean, the most obvious thing that people often point to is the plague, right? That is sweeping through Europe and killing vast swaths of people, which really puts people in touch with, wow, I'm really vulnerable. Like, things could end really quickly. There's also a kind of greater individualism because there are these sort of political changes that are happening with cities and the rise of a kind of middle class, merchant class, and writing in the vernacular languages and that sort of thing. Mm. A lot of this kind of passion mysticism arises often among women, as women were looking for, nuns were looking for ways to experience or to show that they were married to Christ. And so there was devotion. I think this is Sarah McNammer who writes about that. And so this then grows and it leaves the monasteries and it becomes something that a lot of people, especially a lot of women, are attending to.
I wonder if we could skip forward in perhaps a reckless way.
Sure.
I'm just so struck listening to you reflect on kind of the plagues of that era. I mean, in a way, we've lived through a recent plague of our own with the COVID-19 pandemic. Mm. And again, conversations about human frailty, illness in the body, and our ecological challenges are all really central again. What connections do you see between, I guess, the contemplative practices of the communities you research and those of our own time. How would you read that? Do you see people now taking them up? What's your read on that?
That's a really hard and interesting question. I'm not convinced that we are taking it up very well. I feel like maybe with just the kind of rise in technology and there's a kind of, I was just rereading Laudato Si, Pope Francis's recent encyclical yesterday, and he talks about a kind of technocracy that is kind of giving us a sense of our own power and a kind of inability to, a kind of powerlessness in the face of our own power. And I think we're struggling to embrace our vulnerability, and we are frightened by suffering, and we are frightened by our fragility, and we're... I'm sure that there are communities that are trying to live into and reclaim these resources, but, you know, nothing really deeply springs to mind because I think we're struggling with it. I think we're losing touch with these difficult truths about ourselves. I don't know if that's the answer that you wanted to hear.
Isn't that a sobering thought, though? I mean, what would it look like, however, to thicken our relationship perhaps with what's there in that tradition that might in fact accompany us in our time as an alternative to, I mean, it's a fascinating idea, that sense of the powerlessness of our own power. And I mean, you must see lots of potential in what you're researching and writing about. And I wonder how you would sketch out what the potential gifts, as you see them, might be of a thicker re-engagement, perhaps.
Yeah, I think for me, the thing I keep coming back to, just in my own journey, because I struggle with this personally a lot, is slowing down. And that sounds like such a kind of cliche, like slow down, but I mean... deeply, deeply slow down. And I've been kind of reciting to myself this line I picked up from Thomas Kelly. And he says, in some we regret to find a well-intentioned but feverish over-busyness not completely grounded in the depths of peace. And we wish they would not blur the beauty of their souls through fast motion. And for me, I have to keep coming back to that because I think everything in my life, even when it comes to teaching these texts to people in a university context, is like trying to trick me into skating around that and moving faster and doing it better. Like it's really insidious. And so for me, these texts that have to do with landscapes and especially the landscapes of inwardness have been really helpful for me to return to and to think about and to maybe even give some thought to, well, what's my landscape and how do I return to that landscape and what does it look like for me to move through it that would encourage a slow movement to that deep place inside where we can be still. And when we are there, to have the courage and the firmness to resist the speed of the outside world. And that is costly. Like, that comes with certain costs. So it's tricky. It's tricky.
I mean, for the mystics, in many cases, it was a communal enterprise, right? They belonged to communities that were very deliberate and intentional about the way they structured time. That is at the heart of what monastic communities were about in many ways. There's that individual yearning that we have to slow down and the steps we might each take perhaps. But I guess for me it raises that question of how together, what would it look like? It's a collective challenge as well, I suspect.
I think that's really wise and a really good observation that you've just made, that moving slowly used to be something that was supported by our communities, especially in, you know, religious contexts or where people were friars or nuns or sisters or monks. And it's hard to find those communities now. I struggle to find those communities. And I don't know the answer to that question. Like, how do we join communities or find communities that are supporting this kind of more contemplative way of being? Because it is so insidious. But I think we have to keep reasserting it, like keep talking about it.
Yeah, I mean, and perhaps to go by foot. I mean, I'm struck that the kind of forest bathing, the forest therapy that we began this conversation with is, apart from the landscape, it's a pedestrian activity, right? Which is about pace. It's about time in and of itself. It's not just movement and the body, but slow movement as well.
Yes, and when we do forest therapy, you know, this is not just something that I do. This is something that is taught in forest therapy practice. Is that, you know, you move very slowly. You do what has been called, you know, quiet aware walking, where you actually slow your pace down, way down, slower than even just a slow walk, and it's. It's sometimes uncomfortable in the beginning. Like, you know, when I take people out, I might have people just go like, I don't know, 15 meters in 20 minutes. It's like ridiculously slow.
It's not hiking, is it?
No, but people love it. Like, people get right into it and they just begin to wander. And I actually have to pay quite a bit of attention to making sure that I can still see where people are and call them back. Because people feel so excited to be set free to go at a human an animal pace, because we're animals and we're never allowed to be. So, but we can give ourselves that permission. Like, we can be intentional about it and carve out spaces and times where we can do that. And then hopefully that begins to seep back into other parts of our lives. But I think that it can't be just this sort of, here, I'll have a practice where I do it a little bit and then I'll go back into the ordinary way of being with my phone and my, you know, all my devices and running from place to place. I think we need to resist the demands of that fast part of our lives as well. Mm. We've got to find a way to do that.
Mm. Yeah, I'm going to think about that, in fact, as I go for my next walk. But thank you. I've really enjoyed talking to you. Thank you so much for being on the show.
And thank you.
Yeah, for sharing just the stories of people who I think are easy to forget or overlook, but whose ideas and perspectives and experiences in the world can really startle us into a fresh perspective on our own time. So thank you.
Thank you.
Rachel Davies, a researcher with the Institute for Religion and Critical Inquiry at the Australian Catholic University in Melbourne. Rachel studies medieval European mystics, and she's also a forest therapy guide. I wonder what it might look like to resist the busyness of contemporary life. Do you think the medievals might have something to offer our fast-paced lives? This is Soul Search by podcast and on ABC Radio National. I'm Meredith Lake, and I just want to linger a moment more on medieval times. Rachel was talking about Francis of Assisi, who wrote his famous Canticle of the Creatures 800 years ago now. But, you know, he also engaged with some of the Muslim thinkers and mystics of his time. Professor Mehmet Özalp is the founder and director of the Centre for Islamic Studies and Civilization at Charles Sturt University. Hi, Mehmet. Great to have you back on Soul Search.
Hi, thanks for having me, Meredith. Good to be here.
How would you describe the big picture of mutual influence between Islamic and Christian thinkers and mystics in the medieval period? Are there particular examples of that that really stand out to you?
There has been theological and spiritual influences, as well as cultural and philosophical as well. The two religions and people, like Christians and Muslims, have interacted for more than 1,000 years in the Mediterranean region, in Syria, starting with Syria, actually, Egypt, and then moving on. So it's been a very influential period. One example that comes to mind is Saint Francis of Assisi, who traveled on a crusader expedition, but he wasn't there to fight. He engaged in dialogues with the ruler of Egypt at the time, Al-Hakim, who was also a caliph, and they had dialogues. They met together, talked about God, God's attributes, and how those attributes manifest in the natural world, which is a very strong theological and spiritual theme in Islam. For Muslims, there's only one God who created the universe. God is transcendent, above and beyond space and time. But at the same time, we can relate to God through God's 99 names or attributes. And these manifest themselves in the natural world and the universe in what Quran calls signs of God. So this has been a major motive in spiritual and mystical discussions in the Islamic tradition. And this this was unique to Muslims, or that emphasis. Saint Francis took that with him back to Europe and started to talk about the way to relate to God through attributes rather than just imagining, you know, in Jesus or in other ways.
So from your perspective, Professor Ozalp, kind of that Islamic influence on St. Francis helps to account for what's now widely regarded as a kind of ecological sensibility in his own theology and practice.
That's right. We all get influence. I mean, I've been in a lot of interfaith dialogue over the last 25 years, especially. And most recently, a couple of weeks ago, we talked in Melbourne about love and compassion in Christianity and Islam. And whenever you talk about your own tradition in this respect, and then you hear the other tradition talk about it, and we inevitably compare and contrast, and we learn from that. It's one of the great aspects of interfaith encounters and dialogues. We end up being enriched in our own tradition while we are learning from others at the same time.
I'd love to hear more about the theological insights and principles that underpin contemporary green Islam, Professor Ozalp. I know you've written a lot about this, but I wonder if you could just kind of paint me a bit of a picture of how strong or developed is what we might call green Islam in the wider picture of Islamic theology and ethics today. How would you join the dots from that medieval period through to now when it comes to Islamic reflections on environmental questions?
It has started in early 80s. There's been some writings on environmentalism and the need to, you know, protect the environment. And there's a very strong motive in the Quran where, you know, God says, I will create a caliph on earth. And caliph means vicegerent, someone who has responsibility over the earth and also right to use the resources of the earth as well. So that balancing of benefiting from the world but at the same time looking after it was a very strong motive in Islam, early Islamic environmentalism in the last century. Later on, in early this century, more writings have come about more theological foundations of environmental protection. And then in 2015, there was a declaration in Istanbul, a gathering of some scholars who made an 8-page declaration on Islamic response to climate change. And March this year, 2025, there's been a second publication called Al Mizan, the care for the earth and responsibility for looking after the earth, and that is now 58 pages, and it takes the environmentalism into a new phase, which is ethical actually considerations, like what do we actually do about it from an Islamic perspective, because in Islam every action is qualified with either an obligation, prohibition, or recommended, or not recommended. Obviously, if something is an obligation, Muslims believe that they must do that, otherwise they are accountable to God in the afterlife. So I argued in another chapter that looking after the environment is an obligation upon Muslims.
I'm really curious about the specific Islamic foundations for that obligation. And I guess I talk to people from all kinds of different faith traditions about their ecological perspectives and sensibilities, and I know that they can vary quite a lot. So from that, you know, theological perspective within Islam, why is there an obligation, as you put it, to care for creation? What's the basis of that coming from that perspective?
The main thing is that human beings are created as a caliph on earth, as I mentioned earlier. That's strong in the Quran. The Quran talks about an amana, or a trust given to human beings. And we could extend from the that being created as caliph, that the whole earth is a trust to human beings. So which means you're trusted something that's valuable and that you have to return it intact. You know, you don't want to damage it. So it's not yours. It's not ours, the planet. The planet belongs to the creator. It's we're like a guest who is invited in here to view the wonderful creation of God and to appreciate that art and artistry in creation and applaud that wonderful creation and then relate to God in that way. So this is a spiritual and theological perspective. And there is also, the Quran talks about plants and animals are communities like you. This is a quotation directly from the Quran. The Quran talks about the balance in chapter 55, that the firmament, the universe, cosmos is in balance, the earth is in balance, and then we are commanded, there's a commandment there to keep everything in its right due balance. So if human activity is, therefore, causing imbalance to the detriment of the life forms that have been created by God, if we're not able to protect that, and that animals are going in mass extinction as a result of human activity, therefore we are directly responsible and accountable on the protection of the earth.
This gets very complex, as I'm sure you're aware, in terms of the allocation of responsibility, causality, those kinds of things. And I guess, I mean, forgive me, but what kind of comes to my mind is that many Muslim majority states, on a number of them, are also oil producing states upon which the wider world relies for its fossil fuels. And I guess I'm sure this is a conversation that happens among Islamic theologians, but how do you extend the kind of principles you're describing into that, both the statecraft and the economic reality of some of those Muslim majority nations? Is there much of a conversation going on around that from people who are reflecting both Quranically and ethically, you know, on these questions?
There is, but not sufficient. I have to admit, there are Muslim thinkers and scholars who are environmentally aware and they're writing about it, but they're not too many in comparison to all the discourse and conversations that are taking place. Understandably, there are a lot of problems in the Muslim world, you know, most recently Gaza being one. And there are many political issues, economic issues. The environment, in terms of from a religious discourse, doesn't make the top of the list. I actually came up with an idea of every once a year on Friday sermons, we could talk about the environment in all the mosques at the same time, just to give that once a year awareness that this is an important matter, important issue in our time. It's also Quran and Islam actually gives us there's teachings there, there's obligations there. We have a responsibility, religious responsibility, to do something about it. So I wish we can achieve that. I have that as an idea and a project, just couldn't get around to do it. It's not easy to organize, obviously. All of the mosques have to be coordinated, they have to agree. But I'd love to do that. And if we can achieve that in Australia, and then it can spread across the world. But as you can see, it does take some activism. It's not just writing about it is not enough. It's certainly important, and I'm, as an academic, but I'm also thinking, okay, how can we make this as a more active and people actually do things about it? At the same time, Muslims are in general aware from the general awareness that's already there, that they hear about what others are doing, what's being done or the problems that we are seeing in the world with climate change and all the negative effects. And they're moved by that and they take action. One example is in 2019, there was in Turkey, a gold license was given in mountains, where pristine mountains, and the trees were cleared. And there was a massive protest about that, which resulted in that license being cancelled. So people said, we can do without gold, but we don't want to do without the trees. There's been an example in Azerbaijan, similar. There was a dam related to gold. In Indonesia, palm oil and deforestation that happens with that. There's a lot of protests. I think the Muslim governments have responsibility. Like there's a obligation on every Muslim, but there's an obligation on Muslim governments because they're the ones who come up with policies and the legal legislative backbone of all of these things. They appear to be more sensitive and reduce carbon footprint, and they are signatories to all these international treaties related to environment. But when it comes to giving these licenses where actually damage will be done, they just also do that as well. So more pressure has to be put on them.
And not only in Muslim societies. I mean, we could think of any number of examples of what you're describing from many parts of the world. On ABC Radio National, you're listening to Soul Search. I'm Meredith Lake, and I'm in conversation today with Professor Mehmet Özalp from Charles Sturt University. Mehmet, you mentioned trees, and that caught my interest because I know that the tree in many religious traditions is a really potent and powerful symbol. And I wonder if you could just take me back to Ibn Arabi, the famous mystic of the 13th century. Tell me a little bit about him and his kind of analogical reflection on trees.
Ibn al-Arabi is a great Muslim mystic and has a major influence on just about every aspect of Islamic spirituality. He does compare the universe as a tree, like the galaxies and stars are like branches, fruits on this tree. And that then you need a seed to that, right? If there's a tree, there must be a seed. And for Ibn al-Arabi, human being is a seed. So we come to this world in a seed-like form, full of potential, and that we go through life realizing this spiritual potential, in a way grow, blossom, and then give branches out, develop, mature. And then we give fruits. The fruits are our behaviors, the good behaviors, the compassion that we show to the life forms and the people around us. That includes like people, animals, plant, basically the entire environment. So we are connected inherently in that respect, connected to the natural world. And we are concerned about it. If we see some fire, bushfire, or an animal suffering, we are moved to actually do something about that. So that's a very strong analogy there. With that tree analogy, human beings become very valuable as well. So there's a value in human life, but there's value in all life forms by virtue of our connection to them, by virtue of the creation being the creative product of God as well. So this understanding of value, you can only look after something or treat it well if you think it's valuable. If we just see everything as resource to be used and benefit from, then we will continue to damage the environment, the consumerism that comes with that, the economic productions or waste production. We have to see great value in the creation.
And that's precisely why I've come to realise that the theological conversations really matter, because so many people across the world do affiliate with a religious tradition, community, belief. What difference would it make for, those Friday sermons to happen, for that kind of consciousness to become maybe near the top of the pile for the Muslims of the world?
Well, it matters because if the on the Friday prayer or in an Islamic talk, the person, the teacher says, oh, look, the earth is created for you to benefit from it. So take whatever you can. The people then will say, oh, okay, they will not feel responsibility to look after it. But if you say you created as a vicegerent on earth, this earth is given to you as a trust, so you have to return that trust, then you have a motivation to or impulse to protect this. So that makes a huge difference, how we teach religion. I'll give you another example. In Indonesia, there was some fishermen were using dynamite. You know, they blow up in the sea and then kill all the fish and then collect it. But that was also damaging the corals and other ecosystems there. So some activists went to these fishermen and said, look, what you're doing is Islamically wrong. Islam says this, for us to look after the environment. You shouldn't be using dynamite. And they actually stopped using it. Because religion has that power that you're not only driven by that selfish reason, but you say, I'm accountable for this before God. God is all-seeing. He will question me in afterlife if I do something wrong. And therefore, I must be very careful and do the right thing. This is how Muslims think. The Quran is very strong in this amal al-salih, which means good deeds. Doing good deeds is a positive thing for Muslims, that we believe it's recorded by angels, all of our good deeds. And then in afterlife, when we are questioned about our earthly lives, what we did on earth, these good deeds will be shown to us. And you only attain salvation, yes, if you believe in God, but also if your good deeds outweigh your bad deeds. So the more you collect, the better it is, actually, for your eternal life.
Just finally then, I wonder what brings you most hope as you contemplate the current situation, the future that's before us all. Where are you seeing encouraging signs of something that brings you hope as you reflect on these things?
One good hope is that these COP meetings are happening being held in Muslim countries. It was held in Egypt, Dubai as well. Turkey's trying to get it. I think that's really great. It means exposure in those countries, and the government's taking the ownership of the problem. I think that gives us hope from an Islamic perspective. But from an overall perspective, in terms of the whole globe and all of humanity, I don't know if we're going forward in this, to be honest. We are making some roadway. However, at the same time, the problem of environmental destruction is continuing, and I'm not sure if we are catching up and reversing the situation.
All the more reason to draw on the resources that we have.
Certainly.
To face that reality, whether they are religious or otherwise. Professor Ozalp, thank you for being back on Soul Search.
Thank you. I enjoyed the conversation.
Professor Mehmet Ozalp from the Centre for Islamic Studies and Civilization at Charles Sturt University. He's the author of several research articles on Islamic approaches to environmental protection. And there's plenty more to listen to if you're interested in the meeting of spirituality and ecology. Just head online to the Soul Search episode page and follow the links you'll find there. For now, big thanks to producers Hong Jiang and Rowan Salmond. I'm Meredith Wake, and I'll catch you for Soul Search again by podcast, on Radio Australia and on ABC Radio National.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.